Conference Committee on Senate File 166 comes back to order. And we've gone through the side-by-side. We've had conversation about likely, you know, or not really likely, but people's interests and concerns. Concerns about how the rebuttable presumption would work. It sounds like there's some interest in seeing how we could make what the Senate did mesh with what the House did. Maybe we could do both pieces. And then I think I just wanted to mention a few more things, and I wanted to take a little testimony from people who have an interest or may have concerns about anything that we've talked about. I just wanted to mention, I think I did already when we were on page R3, just at the very bottom, that's the language that caused consternation in the House, and I think we'll be looking at some kind of an accommodation with that language, and perhaps we will be doing that. And then I think we still need to discuss whether or not we want 4 or 5 years. That's, you know, I'd like to hear some input from members of the conference committee. I'm thinking that we might, just tossing this out, I don't want to surprise anybody with anything. I'm thinking of maybe taking out the or otherwise wager on life language, just because we don't really refer to that anyplace else in the bill. And then I think that we might want to talk about, well, I know we want to talk about statute of limitations. I don't know if we've finished that conversation yet or not. And then I'm also thinking that we may want to look at changing the effective date, although both bills have it the same. I was thinking kind of along the lines of the day after final enactment, but does anybody else have anything that they wanted to discuss? Senator Moore?
Madam Chair, since that was the rebuttal presumption and the regulatory mechanism was the last thing that the Secretary left, maybe the numbers can give input, but my sense was that we had tentatively reached a consensus to say that we would like to perhaps have the chairs take a look at the Senate language on the rebuttable presumption, narrowing it to civil action, and then build into that the House language on the governmental regulation pieces of the different actors. And I'm wondering if the other committee members would be willing to, for the time being, given the other work that we need to be doing to two chairs, perhaps have a chance to talk about that and come back to us with a recommendation on how we could marry both the House and the Senate language with those parameters.
Is there any other thought on that? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a great idea because splicing that language here within the confines of this committee might be a very challenging thing to do.
Representative Kidd.
Madam Chair, I think trying to figure out how to make these both happen because, you know, the House did take a position, did vote out the rebuttable presumption in the committee on a roll call vote. It wasn't a roll call, division vote. And, you know, we have the 4 or 5 years. I think we'll talk about the 4 or 5 years, but that's, I think, another place where we have a big difference, so we need to be looking at how we might work that out. But I do think, you know, having the better understanding of the rebuttal presumption and how big of a deal that is in the criminal world Representative Hillstrom, Representative Atkins helped me figure that out. I think that that we definitely wouldn't want the rebuttable presumption in the criminal section of law. So I'm happy to keep working on language with you.
Yeah. Right. I think we're going to need help from staff to help us clarify that that's in civil action. And I don't know, how do other members feel? Representative Atkins?
With due respect, I think that was the assumption all along, was that we were talking about in a civil action. Then we had the discussion this morning prompted by Mr. Pender's comment about, well, for heaven's sakes, this might apply in criminal cases. And that then led to sort of the follow-up. But I think if we're and I'm not, Representative Hillstrom, you sit on the Civil Justice Committee, but I think their assumption was that the rebuttable presumption was going to apply in civil cases, and they were not comfortable with that. that was how the bill was presented. If I'm wrong, just share that with me, but that made them uncomfortable from a civil law standpoint. And maybe we could consult with Chairman Mullery or something too. Or if,
We're both on that committee.
And
we lost that vote.
I'm trying to remember why.
Okay.
It was a, it was a 7-6 division vote.
Yes.
This is Senator Moore.
My perspective is that I don't see us being an either or, that the House has a very strong position in its language, and the Senate has a very strong position in its language. And I think that there's an opportunity here for us to, for our two chairs to take a look at the language, both in the Senate and the House, and that there's actually an opportunity here for us to get both strongly accepted language, both in the Senate and the House, in a way that makes sense. And
that doesn't contradict.
That doesn't contradict. And I don't think that they contradict. And I think that we could find a way to do that. I believe that. And I don't think that it's a matter of taking one or the other, but that there's an opportunity here to do that, and I'd like to pursue that before we get deeper into conversations about, you know, with the conference committee. And I know that the votes are hard, but, you know, we're the conference committee, and we get to make the decisions.
and then we have to go back to our respective
right,
bodies
right,
and pass it.
Right.
I understand that.
And if we can come back to them with both sets of language, I think that makes it a good argument for us. And, in fact, I think it signifies that we've done our work.
Welcome, Senator Clark.
It's good to
I'm
be
calling
here.
People
I'm
representatives.
So sorry I couldn't be with you this morning. Hopefully, Madam Chair, you got a chance to tell members. The Cold Spring Middle School in St. Boniface is between two Senate and House districts, and I was trying to deal with some of the new flu as opposed to swine flu this morning. So I'm sorry I wasn't here. However, I think the idea of trying to come up with something where you've got both of the strong positions coming back in a way that actually is harmonized would be a really good thing, and I think for both our bodies looking at something maybe in a different way than they have before. So I think the work that you've been doing has been great. And we're going to send the memo out about color for clothing, I guess. Zach Herlock missed the memo today. But
he was so embarrassed he didn't come back, yeah. No, he couldn't be here now.
So is the House supposed to we wear our red suits tomorrow?
Senator Moore and I have been having fun. We sit next to each other on the Senate floor, and we've been having fun. And the best part of it all was when Senator Scoy noticed the two of us were wearing the same color every day. That we got a big chuckle out of that, and then it just kind of spread.
Chair.
Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
On the tax conference committee last year, that was done every day.
Oh, no.
Senator Moore.
Oh, see? She's dangerous.
Infectious.
That's a word. That's the word. That's the word.
Building community.
Madam Chair, I suggest we pick it in solidarity with one of the co-chairs of the conference committee. We choose a different color tomorrow.
It's bright blue.
Bright blue. Oh. Do you ever do bright orange?
That's
for
Fridays. That's for
Fridays. I know you
Fridays.
Love orange.
Okay.
Hey,
yeah,
see?
This is actually orange. I love our Senate friends, but it's
oh, sure.
Out of, up. I think we're a little closer.
To our chair.
Yes, I'm impressed. I'm impressed.
It's an orange.
Oh, yeah. I would never presume to interpret that color to be like
that. Can I...
So, Representative Atkins.
The one piece that I'd suggest, the idea or the term that the calling it a rebuttable presumption does make a lot of folks a little uncomfortable, and I think it might, of the seven that voted on the one side of it in our civil law committee, if we don't use the term as we try to marry the two strong concepts, I think it might be helpful for, as we take it back to our brothers and sisters in the House, just trying to be constructive. I think we can have strong language, but if we don't necessarily make it a rebuttable presumption per se.
Is it defined? Is rebuttable presumption defined only in the courts, or is it defined in statute? Madam Chair.
Well, I don't think it's in, is it defined in statute? I think it's a.
It is what it is. We've got it. Yeah. Explicitly, it's in the Senate bill. I think you can have strong language, as both sides have, without necessarily making it a...
You're suggesting we call it something else.
Well...
Define it.
Yeah, I'm just sensing that if we come back with that on the... because you're right, we do have strong language in both bills. And I think strong language is merited by the fact that all of us want to try to prevent this sort of product, this sort of thing from occurring. It's just when we take it back, we will have some folks that...
Seven.
Are respectful of the committee process in the House. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. I do, Representative Atkins. Yes, Senator Clark.
I think, in general, that kind of thing is a good thing if we're talking about defining it. I have to admit, having worked on the nonprofit tax exemption a fair amount, that when you start marrying different legal terms, I would get worried if we started sending a signal to the court that they might think this is something new and different than something that is a pretty well-defined, easily understood term for them. And that's kind of what started happening over there as they started marrying different words, and then I think people started wondering what the heck it meant. So, Mike, I'm going to express a concern that unless we're very clear about what this means, that we could create a bigger problem than seven people that were on it. So I think that's if you could figure that out, fine, but I think it's got to be very clear to the courts what we mean and to the lawyers.
On that exact point, that idea of a rebuttable presumption, it's one of the House research folks said that apparently there's only 34 instances in all of Minnesota law that do it.
But everybody knows what it is. I mean, if you're a lawyer, you know what it is.
I don't think you want
to be mixing things up. That would be my concern. Whatever we do, it just needs to be clear, and that we're not looking like we're calling something one thing when it's really something else, because then I think it will get more muddy in the law. But I have good faith in our good counsel to try to – that would just be something to keep in, take into account while they're looking.
The reason that I bring it up is because I actually practice in an area that's somewhat related where we have – a concept. It's no-fault arbitrations, and we go back and forth with there is an area where there's a rebuttable presumption, or arguably one.
I practice an area with it, too.
And we go back and forth over who's got the burden.
Right.
When you put in the rebuttable presumption language. If it's just, all right, here's what you got to prove, then that's what you got to prove. This shifting back and forth of the burden is, it really makes for some long, labored discussions about who's got to do what. And I have every confidence that our chairs and with the assistance of counsel can figure that out. But the idea of a rebuttable presumption makes a lot of people very nervous that doing it in that fashion. But at least from the House perspective, one particular committee and certain members of that committee.
Madam Chair, we just
yes,
want,
yes, Senator Clark.
We just want to make sure we're not getting into what is the definition of this. Let's face it, we as lawyers, a lot of times the argument on standards or burden of proof is all about arguing about who's really got to prove what. And my point only, I think, again, your point was well taken. We just don't want to muddy it further because they're still going to argue about that kind of stuff no matter what we do.
Any other sections that anybody wanted to talk about? Did you want to talk about the 4 versus 5?
The longer you have it, the stronger it is. But I do think it, depending on how we come to terms with the other parts, the House position of the 4 is important, but I do think we're not experts in the financing of STOLIA policy, so this might be an area where it would be useful to have some testimony.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do want to do that. So, I mean, I think I like the 5-year because I think 4 years is pretty typical. That's about as long as an investor wants to finance, from what I can tell. I mean, certainly no, I don't, you know, this bill is as close as I've come to the world of life settlement agreements, but it's my understanding from what I've read that the financing agreements often are about 4 years, and that's about as long as people want to invest their money into that contract. Representative Atkins, that's okay.
A graph or something? I believe Ms. Rohn had something, and you all may be more familiar with it, but it was like 38 months or something. It was between 3 and 4 years. And I should go
okay.
through the chair.
Okay, Rohn, I don't remember that. Ms. Rohn, do you have something like that?
I might be completely off base, but I thought there was something that was shown.
I do have a little visual that's actually, do I
go up here. Yeah.
Sorry. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Robin Rohn. I do have a chart, but I don't have it with me. It's based on life settlement data, and it shows basically I believe it represents $2.3 billion worth of life settlements, how many take place within each time frame. And between 0 and 2 years, which is the contestability period, it was very low. Then there's a spike after 2 years. Then it drops a little between 3 and 4, and then there's a big spike after 4 years, which the graph itself, and I can provide it to the committee the next time they meet. I just don't have a paper copy with me. The spike after 4 years, and the graph basically says those represents the policies that were actually purchased for legitimate life insurance. So that's kind of how the graph, very low between 2 and 4, I mean between 0 and 2, big spike after 2, which is the end of the contestability period, drops a little between 3 and 4, and then spikes again after 4. Is that how you recall?
The one. And then there's, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Atkins.
The after 4, that was lumping all of them. It was like 4 plus.
It was 4 plus, right.
The others were those 3 years.
Oh, there. Representative Loon has the graph. Yeah.
That would be good. Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
If she could just describe or tell us what it is that it's showing so that when we get the graph, we understand the point. Of
right. No, no, we
right
will.
Now.
We'll get them shortly here.
He has one, too.
Yeah, just follow me.
Pardon me? What?
I guess the question is this graph showing that it should be 4 years or it should be 5 years? I mean, that's kind of what I'm trying to get.
Right, right. And I haven't seen it, or at least I don't recall seeing it, so I don't know.
Madam Chair, and the difficulty being, and Representative Atkins and I have talked about this a bunch of times, is the high numbers over here in the 4-plus years are presumably legitimate policies and possibly a few STOLI. In the
right.
The low end of the 4-plus years.
It seems to think this graph seems to make an interpretation that cases in the 4-plus-year bracket are also very common, representing policies originated primarily for use of the insurance product as opposed to, you know, an investment for the purpose of making a life settlement agreement. I just have to share, well, that AIG is now, you recall that some of the troubles they got into had to do with offering products having to do with high-risk mortgages and credit default swap stuff, and they are now saying that they will insure the acquisition of a life insurance policy as part of estate planning, or people who wish to monetize existing life insurance policies that are no longer needed. They may contain non-traditional risks such as longevity, contestability, collateral value, insurable interest, and application misstatements that we may be able to ensure. So somebody ought to tell somebody that they're doing this. They got themselves in trouble the last time. But I know the members here know that many of these these purchases are being securitized and bundled together and sold by bond houses. And it's pretty shocking to my sensibilities in any case. So everybody will have one of these, you know. I like five, but I don't know that it's magic, and it looks like four. So it looks like two and three are, once they get beyond the period of contestability, after the 2 years, that seems to be when I think a lot of this happens, a lot of the, what we would call stalling happening. So I would like to ask if there's anybody here who would like to testify on any of the conversation or any of the parts of either bill that... Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I represent a company called Tamar Fink and a gentleman named Mike Abrams, and they are... They represent consumers who on occasion find the need to sell their life insurance policies. We don't buy policies. We don't settle them. We're not investors. The consumers that they represent are generally looking to divest themselves of an insurance policy for an economic or other reason that brings them to looking to sell their life insurance. And we've had some consumers come in and testify about when they actually had sold their policies and how it benefited them and their family and their estates.
So, and I think they probably testified in both bodies, right?
They did. Yeah. They did. And so I don't represent any of the investors. And Senator Clark, you kind of hit the nail on the head. It is new and different as it relates to this presumption. There isn't a single one like it in the country. And that is one of the concerns we have. Of all the states that have addressed this issue, no one has taken this presumption approach, whether it's in a civil or criminal context, to this issue of stranger-originated life insurance. And we have some concerns about that. And one of our concerns is that as we read the language on the Senate side as it relates to the presumption, the burden is completely on the consumer to demonstrate that they have not engaged in this, what is a fraudulent act, and it's criminal in the bill right now. I understand there may be some discussions about that. But the burden is completely on the consumer, and there is no remedy for the consumer when the insurance carrier does not doesn't approve their rightful transfer of their policy or sale of their policy. There's no remedy for the consumer. And so we have concerns about that. We think the burden is completely on the consumer in an unfair way, and no remedy for them when the insurance company who has all the information does not affect a transfer, a legitimate and legal transfer. And that's how we read on our aid of the side-by-side. That's how we read the balance of, I believe it's Section 6. And when they talk about, they shall not unreasonably delay affecting change of ownership, what is the remedy when they don't? There's nothing. If I need to sell that insurance policy like Mr. Wolk did when he came and testified to these committees, what happens when they do unreasonably delay or unreasonably deny a transfer? There's no remedy for the consumer, and we think that should be at least discussed and possibly addressed by providing a remedy when they do wrongly deny, particularly when you're putting all of the burden on the consumer. I did point out in one of the committees, Madam Chair and members, that violating this for the consumer is a fraudulent act that that carries with it criminal sanctions under section 609, 611, subdivision 3, and for any insurance policy that you would that they would allege is a STOLE transaction, for any policy over $35,000, that is a felony penalty for the consumer, and we believe the rebuttable presumption makes it very difficult for them if an insurer denies their transfer. You are, in effect, saying we are presuming that you have committed a fraudulent insurance transaction, and we think that that is problematic for the consumer. We also have concerns about the statute of limitation and the action to recover, and our position has long been that a STOLE transaction, which is one where there is no insurable interest at the inception of the policy, should be banned. It should be void. And it should not be in any way allowed. And the way both of the bills are set up, even if I have a STOLE in the Senate bill or in the House bill, if I make it past 5 years, I'm okay, even if it was a fraud. We think that's wrong. We think STOLE should be banned as a practice, and I don't see that it is in this bill. And you allow an action for an estate to recover on a STOLE transaction. So you're allowing someone to recover on a fraud. And the way the statute of limitations operates, we think, is confusing because there are different statute of limitations depending on the cause of action that you have. Particularly in the criminal context under 609, we think the statute of limitations on criminal fraud is 3 years. Then there are some discovery provisions, which we haven't even gotten into. We think that whole statute, moving away from what the existing law and understood law is on the statute of limitations, creates a significant problem for consumers. And I don't represent anyone in the settlement industry, but we think that no one will purchase a policy with a 3-year statute of limitation after the date of death because their exposure on that policy that they may purchase is unlimited. That's not my burden to carry, but it's been expressed in committee and we share it on behalf of consumers. A right to sell your property, your insurance is your property, with no market to sell it is not a right at all. And so we have those concerns. We appreciate the effort that everyone has made on this issue and be happy to look at alternatives. But as it's written right now, we think the burden on the consumer in the Senate bill is significant in a way that that we have trouble supporting it.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Carlson, I heard you right. You said if it's a STOLE policy after 4 or 5 years, the House, Senate, they can still sell it and there's no real they can get away with a STOLE policy. So if you're help me understand, if the language is tight enough on the prohibition, you're saying that you don't care about the years, or?
I'm saying that if the prohibition in the bill is on a insurance, life insurance policy, where there is no insurable interest at the inception of the policy, we don't care if it's 20 years after the date. There's no insurable interest at the inception of the policy, which we believe is stranger originated, and we don't think that they should ever be allowed. Whether I pay the premium for 5 years or not, it's a fraud at its inception.
Because I think if there's no insurable interest at the inception of the policy, that it's contestable forever. I mean,
As we have discussed this bill and the difference between the 5-year ban and the 4-year ban, states are that we've looked at are 2. There are a couple that have done a 5-year hold provision. But after that point, the right of the insurance company to contest your transfer of your policy, like in both of these bills, is significantly diminished. And that's the contestability period. And so I would say that if you read this bill, if I hold a STOLE policy for 4 or 5 years, and I sell it after that point, I think that the right of the insurance carrier to contest that is severely diminished, if not eliminated.
Okay.
Be because I can sell it after 5 years, or in one bill, I can sell it after four in another.
Else who would want to speak? Mr. Coyle?
Oh, Madam Chair.
Carlson, please.
Briefly, one more point. As it relates to premium financing, one of the things we talked about in the House committee is, and you touched on it with AIG, but there are a number of insurers that approve premium financing, and we think it's unfair to put me into the position of a stolen practice by having a premium finance package that is actually approved by the insurer. And that happens, and we think it's unfair that that becomes a trigger for pushing me into a potential fraudulent act where the carrier has approved the premium finance at the inception of the policy. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Mr. Coyle. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peter Coyle. I'm an attorney with Larkin Hoffman. I represent a company called Coventry First, which is a national financier of life settlement transactions based in Pennsylvania. Mr. Carlson has covered most of the comments that I was going to offer this evening, Madam Chair. I'll focus only on the way the bill addresses the consumer interaction with their insurance agent and the process by which underwriting occurs on the original issuance of the policy, which, for reasons that the consumer may have no knowledge, could also then inadvertently cause them to be implicated by fraud. The testimony in both the House and the Senate made it clear that the insurance industry, through its underwriting process, routinely uses life expectancy examinations as they construe them, and that they also use insurance premium financing for the acquisition of insurance. And yet this bill criminalizes, if not construes it as civil fraud, the basic information components that go into that underwriting process. Now, I realize that the application of the life expectancy exam for the carriers is different than it might be used for purposes of a life settlement transaction, but the consumer doesn't know any different. Madam Chair, you may recall in the Senate Judiciary Committee there was extensive discussion from Senator Olson, who was saying, I hope I'm not mischaracterizing her statement, but to the effect that I may not even know that I went through a life expectancy examination. They had me sign the forms. I authorized a medical exam. I authorized them to take data. And the consumer may not know any of this. And yet they're relying on their insurance agent, which is through whom they are engaging in this transaction at the front end and potentially on the back end through the life settlement. And yet this bill focuses on them and says if the expectancy exam was done and it was exchanged with a third party for purposes of valuation, which the consumer may know nothing about, and if you had premium financing such as Mr. Wolk had when he purchased his policy, he had no expectation that he was going to sell that policy 3 years later because his business had failed through no fault of his own because of a transaction with a third party. So both of those factors now will implicate Mr. Wolk or someone like him for fraud based on the literal words of this bill. So I would urge you again to reconsider the manner in which the consumer is penalized for actions or activities that are wholly within the control of the insurance company and its agent, who is the primary expert in advising that consumer on how their insurance policy can be bought and potentially sold through a life settlement transaction. Those are my comments, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Well, I think in terms of the life expectancy evaluation, I mean, don't we say that the results were shared or used by somebody to determine the value in the secondary market? I mean, it's not just having the life expectancy evaluation, which I would contend, I don't know that that's routine for insurance companies. I think they usually send, you know, a nurse to your house and they bring their own little scale and they take your blood pressure and ask you if you've had cancer or heart disease or something and, you know, they sign you up.
Madam Chair,
it's a whole lot different than your life's medical history, you know.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that comment. All I can do is direct you to one of the insurance industry's leading experts on insurance underwriting who has stated very strongly that when an insurance policy issues, a life expectancy exam ought to be done. And so there's obviously a difference of opinion about how these are used and how they're applied. All I'm saying is the consumer doesn't know any better. they're sitting with their agent, who is either a direct employee or an authorized agent of the insurance carrier, and the agent says, fill out all this paper, sign all these forms, and we'll complete the underwriting so that you can have a policy issued on your behalf. And so that's what they do. And they may not even know that at some point in that transaction, that life expectancy exam is exchanged with a third party for purposes of valuation. Mr. Wolk may not have even known in his case that his policy was exchanged with a third party for the purpose of assigning a value to it. He may just have thought that Mr. Abrams, who was his agent, was a smart guy. And so at the end of the day, I guess what I've been thinking about is what happens to Mr. Wolk or someone like him when this bill passes, when through no fault of his own, his business fails because the buyer of his company tanks it, and he has no other asset to turn to other than his life insurance policy. But he violated both of these standards as it's written into the bill.
Representative Knuth and then Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Coyle, the preeminent expert, is this Mr. Lineberg that you're talking about,
yeah.
Stephen Lineberg?
Correct.
Because, you know, after the testimony, we got in touch with Mr. Lineberg, and he provided us a letter and frankly thought his work would be misused but didn't think it would get misused quite so quickly as it was in terms of this STOLE. Conversations about this bill about STOLE. And I don't have the first letter he sent me, but I can give you a copy of that if you want. But he also has sent me a second letter after the bill had been amended a couple times. And he has said, and just as quoting his letter, as I've made clear in conversations with numerous life insurance commissioners and their staffs in Florida, Ohio, California, and other states, the procurement of a life expectancy prior to the purchase of life insurance is the single most obvious and common indicator of a STOLE transaction. In fact, because investors will not invest it without knowing in advance how long they will have to pay premiums and how soon they will have to receive their payoff, an LE is almost sine qua non. I don't. Basically, it's the biggest common indicator of STOLE, and this is from the person you're quoting. And I can get you his first letter, too. It's a little more clear because this letter is also talking about some other issues. Yes, it can be used in legitimate life. And I don't, you know, I just, because it, this you quoted this Stephen Lineberg's work on numerous occasions, I just wanted to make clear that he thinks life expectancy evaluations are a very clear indicator of STOLE and are a very common indicator. And you when you tie it with premium financing, it's basically that's STOLE. Just to be clear about what this expert thinks. And also looking at the prohibition, I mean, I appreciate your testimony about not wanting to have the consumers taken, have them be convicted of fraud and things, but the way we've written this is to prohibit the purchase of this policy. The people who the insurance is purchased on are, in often cases, they're the victims of fraud. They might not know, and they might have huge tax implications. And so this is specifically written to not, to be on the purchasers, or the agent is the one who's the probably. I don't think we have consumers going out there and saying, let's do STOLE on me, unless they're brought into it by an agent or a broker, and we're writing the language to address that. So I just wanted to clarify that Stephen Lineberg does think life expectancy evaluations are a common indicator of STOLE, if not the most common, and we're really not writing language to have the elderly person in this case be implicated with fraud. It is the agent or the broker or the purchaser who's kind of doing it around this person's life, and that's really what we want to get at. So we want to make sure the language does that. I appreciate that testimony. I would agree with that.
Well, Madam Chair, I have to say that this is the third time I've had an encounter with Mr. Wolf, whether it's in presence or, you know, in absentia, and I have to say that I've done a lot of work with Mr. Coyle, and I think that he is a person of integrity, so I would never want to cast any, you know, doubt on his intention here. But I have to say that I felt that through all the testimonies, it was well settled that the language we have proposed, particularly in, I will speak only to the Senate language, would not impact Mr. Wolf's situation. And the reason why I am confident in that is that in the Senate language, we specifically say that at the time of policy origination, that the third-party investor has no insurable interest in the issue. And in Mr. Wolf's specific situation, there is a demonstrable insurable interest in him and his life insurance because he is the sole manager of his company. And so we had established that there was an insurable interest. And in fact, his situation, even if that, if this law, if the Senate language were to become law, but his situation would not be affected by it because we have chosen to ensure that. And I, and so Mr. Coyle, I thought that in the Judiciary Committee, we spent a lot of time talking about it, both with Mr. Abrams there and with Mr. Wolf there, and I believe that that either it was Mr. Abrams or Mr. Wolf that I asked this particular question. And it was on the record stated that under the specific elements of what we've laid out here, that it would not affect Mr. Wolf's situation. So I am having a difficult time putting his fact scenario into what the language we have here.
What page are you?
I'm looking at R3.
Okay.
Matt is having a difficult time. And I think that we... Yeah. I just want us to be talking from, you know, the same position, because I don't think that Mr. Wolf is a very good example, and his facts are not very good facts if we're going to challenge the application of our language.
Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Senator Scheid. We had a very similar discussion in civil justice before the amendment was offered about how even if the language that was then in the bill were in existence, that that would not have precluded him in his situation from doing what he needed to do to protect his financial interest, because of the fact that it created a rebuttable presumption, but not a conclusive one. And so that was very, very similar to my understanding as well in our conversation in the House Civil Justice Committee.
Great. Okay. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, just looking at R6 on the Senate side, I believe what he said is he didn't know if this would apply to him or not. I don't think he said it didn't apply.
I don't recall that, Senator Ma. I know he said he just wasn't qualified to know that. But what I can tell you from what I know from speaking with him is that when they did that, when they issued his policy when he was in the process of transitioning out of his business, he clearly had a life expectancy done. That happened. He didn't know if that was shared by his agent on line 7.13 with any purpose for determining the actual potential value of the policy in the secondary market. He didn't know that if his agent did that, what's going to happen if this, you know, if I have to bail out. So he didn't know if that happened or not. He clearly did not have, on R7, he didn't have an agreement or understanding to sell his policy at the time of inception. But then the big question becomes on 7.20 through 7.23 as to the nature of how he financed his policy through his business sale. And what he said he didn't know was whether or not the business paying for part of it or borrowing for part of it would implicate this. And what Mr. Abrams followed up with, what I recall, is that because of that uncertainty, he didn't think he would be able to find anybody in the secondary market to buy his policy.
Senator Moore.
And Madam Chair, I recall saying that it's too bad that Mr. Abrams is Mr. Wolf's advisor, because I think that if you look at the language, Mr. Wolf can claim that he doesn't know
not sure, and he's uncertain. But I think that we've made very clear the elements here, and if Mr. Wilkes is paying the kind of money that he is paying to get the kind of advice that he's getting, I sure hope that whoever is advising him is accurately reading the language that's in the statute and not to distort it. Now, I look at this, and I think that we were clear and we were explicit in our discussion that in Mr. Wilkes' case, because his corporation is paying for his policy, and we know that that's tied to the fact that they have an insurable interest in his life as a partner in that policy, that the issue has already been resolved before it even gets to this element of the bill. So I will concede that there is, may create or cast a doubt or shadow and uncertainty about whether or not he could do it. But, you know, there's some really good, smart people whom he's working with. And I think that if they were to do a thorough analysis, I would think that the conclusion would be that he wouldn't be threatened or he would not be vulnerable to the language they have proposed here. And I just have to say that I've listened very carefully to the testimony. I have tremendous respect for the both of you and the position that you're trying to advocate for. But having Mr. Wolf's fact pattern being used in this example does not strengthen your argument for why. And the most persuasive argument that you've given is that this, by creating this new mechanism, may create uncertainty in the market, and that may somehow chill the activities. I accept that. And I think it's acknowledged by all of us that anytime you do something new, there's a potential chilling impact. But I think that that's been addressed. We've talked about it. And I think it's that from a policy perspective, we acknowledge that. But we're willing to, despite a potential chilling impact, to move in this direction. That's the deliberation that has taken place. And so, I don't mean to come down so hard on the two of you, but I've become a little bit impatient with the fact scenario with Mr. Wolf's case because I don't think that it's helpful in the argument in opposition to language we have in front of us.
Yeah. Mr. Carlson.
I'm sure I hesitate to speak further, but let's assume that in Mr. Wolf's situation, let's assume that his life expectancy was shared with someone to determine what the value of that policy would be worth 3 years down the road if your business can't pay these very substantial premiums. Well, what can I do? You know, that was part of the life curve analysis, which is, I think, the term that the author used, is to be informed. So let's say it was. What would that be worth in 3 years from now? I paid in $100,000 a year, and now I don't have that. What would it be worth 3 years from now? That is, in my estimation, reading this language, just automatically triggers him into stolen. If he does that, if he gets informed about what happens 2, 3, 4 years down the road before the inception of the policy,
that's.
And then, if he has a premium finance arrangement, whether it's approved by the insurance carrier or not, in his situation, we believe he'd be unable to sell his insurance within that that 2 to 5 year period in the Senate language. And he did nothing wrong at the inception of his policy. That's our concern. Is, you know, let's say he did have his agent find out what's going to happen. I want information. I'm putting in a bunch of money here. These are not, you know, inexpensive policies. I want to find out what's going to happen here if I need to bail out. And well, you might be able to sell it on secondary market. You might be able to cash surrender it. So I get that information as a consumer. That automatically triggers what I believe is subdivision 1.
Okay, let's say it triggers that, Mr. Carlson, but if he's funding it either by his own personal assets or recourse financing, full, you know, where he's liable for the payment, then it doesn't trigger it.
Or Madam Chair, or Representative if he's using his personal assets or someone closely related by blood or law or who has a substantial economic interest in the continued life,
if that's
other words, his company, I mean, that's the basic insurable interest. So if his company financed this or he financed this, he doesn't trigger the second part, whether or not he had a life expectancy evaluation and whether or not he knew about it.
And I don't believe this happened in Mr. Wolk's situation, but hypothetically, what if he had some carrier-approved provision of recourse and non-recourse financing to fund this policy? He did not. As I understand it,
we will just say another person.
Exactly.
Another person might have.
Right, and it's approved by the carrier at the time of inception. You know, they know of it. They know the financing. They approve it. Many of them fund them. And I know you just brought up AIG as one and ING as well. That means if I do that, clearly legitimate up front, I have no intention to sell it. I've got insurable interest. But if I finance it this way and I get the information at the inception of my policy, I'm barred from selling that in the Senate bill in the first 5 years. And we think that's we want to ban STOLI. We think that's an odious practice. But we think this has some serious implications for consumers who get information and then are unable to sell their property. And I don't want to be argumentative. I'm just thinking that's a logical outcome from this language.
I'd like to hear maybe, I don't know, Ms. Ruin or somebody about insurer financing of policies and how you see that being affected here. If that's, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Question?
And Madam
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Just
Thanks
so
for your
we
time.
Can,
represent.
I know I have several members who need to be out by 6.
Yes,
so I want
and
to
we
sure
intend
we
to be.
Get done by then.
Yeah.
Madam
yes. So can you answer that? In a bit? Yeah. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sandy Nairn, and I'm with Messer Lane Kramer, and our firm represents a national settlement company called Peachtree Settlement. And I do want to go on the record saying that our company strongly supports legislation to clearly ban STOLI. We have been involved in all 50 states working on different legislation, and we have strongly supported banning STOLI. Our company doesn't engage in STOLI practices, and we have as much interest as a life insurance company does in making sure that bad actors get knocked out of the box. They don't help anybody's reputation. We do believe that this bill improved as it moved through the process and as it had more hearings in the House. We think the House language is preferable to us for the reason that we think it has more clear lines and setting out the rules for what is a STOLI transaction. It clearly says what is STOLI. It clearly says that if you don't engage in life expectancy exams 18 months before, and if you don't do non-recourse financing, which our company does not do, we would be excluded from the language of the House bill. We would not be adversely impacted if you do not engage in those kinds of practices. So we think the lines are much more clear on the House side in clearly doing that. We are concerned about the presumption language in the Senate bill because the practical effect of it is to shift the burden of proof to the insurer and or the consumer to try and prove a negative. It's unusual in civil law to do that kind of thing, and we think it's a tough burden for those who legitimately do this kind of work to do it. If something similar to the House bill passes, our company would not be adversely impacted because they don't do non-recourse financing and they do not engage in STOLI practices. So by definition, they would not be included in the bill. And at that point, actually, the number of years that you ban it is almost secondary because if you're not included to begin with, the number of years don't matter as much to you. So we have suggested to the authors a couple language changes that correspond with some of the
language that is in the department bill on viatical settlements, on recovery of costs and expenses, and a few technical things like that. But and we would prefer, if possible, some language to give investors comfort that they would not get sued after the fact, one, by having the burden of proof, or two, by not having some kind of certification from the insured that they did not engage in these practices at the front end. Because, of course, an investor coming in 3-4 years later is not going to know for sure that the insured didn't engage in some practices when they weren't involved. So that is all I really wanted to say about the bill. We do support legislation passing, and we are not opposed to the concept in its entirety. And we do think that the language got a little better as it had more and more hearings, and at least has clear lines for people who operate in this field to know exactly what is illegal and to know exactly whether when they're knocked out of the box. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Saying the House language being very tightly drawn, the number of years doesn't matter because if it's STOLE, it's STOLE. Or you said it became a secondary issue, and so I'm just wanted you to clarify that a little bit more.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Knuth, in other states, the number of years, as you know, has mostly been 2 years. There have been 5 states that have done 5 years. But North Dakota just amended their law to also put a 2-year provision along with the 5-year provision in there. Ohio has a 5-year provision, but again, by definition, our company is not included in there because it clearly says only if you engage in STOLE practices do you have a 5-year prohibition. So while we would prefer a low number of years, I think more importantly, we want to make sure we're not included in the definition. And if the law clearly says that you are only guilty, you're only involved in this bill if you engage in STOLE practices and do non-recourse financing as 2 of the 3 main criteria, my company's not impacted by the law.
Senator Wong. If your company's not impacted by the law, then your objection to the rebuttal presumption is more in theory.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, no, it's not theory, it's practical, because what basically will happen is we will not have investors who are going to be willing to accept the burden of proof in a legal action. That's basically what we believe the presumption will accomplish, is it will say you, the prospective purchaser, are going to end up with the burden of proof to prove that you didn't engage in a practice, that there wasn't a STOLE practice at the beginning of the transaction. And, of course, an investor, an ultimate investor who wasn't involved at the front end at all, it has no way of proving that. That's why we've asked for some language that says, let us rely on a certification from the insured. So the burden of proof, we think, will make it difficult, Senator Ma, for investors to be willing to purchase the product. So we'll have a hard time selling it with the burden of proof language. But with the House language, where it clearly says you are guilty of STOLE if you do the following, we're okay with that language. That doesn't knock us out of the box.
Well, Madam Chair, my read on that is that I guess this is from your perspective. Because if you don't engage in those 3 things that we described, the triggers of STOLE, the triggers of presumption, then why do you even worry that the burden applies to you?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, it the burden applies to the people we're trying to sell the product to. So that if no investors are going to assume the legal risk of getting sued and having to have the burden of proof, then we won't be able to sell it. I do think that, in effect, the Senate language probably acts almost as a ban, because the market will, for investors, they won't take the legal risk of buying a lawsuit.
Well, Madam Chair, well, so then what about the states that have passed these laws? I mean, we've asked this question, and it's my understanding that, I can't remember which state it was, but even though they did something that was very comprehensive, that in effect worked similar to our presumption, and yet there was not a significant impact on their secondary market.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore. No state has done a presumption. This is not passed anywhere. There have been several states that have passed a ban, a five-year ban, which is a little bit different than a presumption of a lawsuit. I think that your presumption is going to act as a five-year ban. I think that's what practically it will end up doing. North Dakota did have a five-year ban in their law. They were the first state to pass a STOLE bill. They sold four life settlements in their state in entirety last year. That's why they recently changed their law, loosened it a little bit, and have some two-year language in addition to their five-year language. Ohio passed a five-year ban, but as I mentioned, their five-year ban, by definition, does not include people who don't engage in STOLE transactions or non-recourse financing, so it didn't impact us. And it was there was no language shifting the burden of proof in a lawsuit.
I'm just not convinced. I think that our presumption was an attempt to address the more strict five-year ban. I think that the one state may demonstrate that there's been some impact, but I believe that there are other states who have had bans in place where we've gotten letters from companies who operate in those states saying that we have not experienced a demonstrable impact. And so I would think that we're not doing a ban. We're creating an opportunity here to create the presumption, but the person who is triggering the process for the presumption has to be able to prove in order for the rebuttable presumption to come into effect. And I just don't think it's true.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Moore, could you maybe respond? Maybe my question didn't make sense, but I was concerned about financing on the part of life insurance companies. I just want to hear that, and then we're probably going to be.
Well. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Robin Rowan, a couple of things. First of all, I think what Ms. Niren pointed out about the presumption is very important because she pointed out that it's the burden is on the investor, not the consumer, as was indicated earlier. It's the investor that's required, the person who buys it. And we strongly believe that in most cases they should know what they're buying to some extent. We don't think they should be buying STOLE policies. I think and they should be able to take reasonable steps to determine that they're not, because why would they want a fraudulent policy? There's plenty of good life settlements out there that they can buy that are legitimate, like the one Carl Walk has. And I think the specific question you asked was about insurance companies
and premium financing.
First of all, we would never approve non-recourse financing, which is the only thing that either bill applies to. Both bills limit it to non-recourse financing, which means the insured has no skin in the game, which means that it is STOLE policy. Because that's the only way you can entice seniors to engage in these transactions, because they don't want insurance in the first place. So it's the non-recourse financing that is the absolute, that is another key to it in addition to the LE. So no insurance company would approve that. Insurance companies don't approve financing agreements anyway. You know, the issue is that they use multiple trusts to hide how the policy is financed. If someone came in and said there was non-recourse financing, we would be suspicious immediately and look at it and figure out it was STOLE and not issue the policy to begin with. The problem is they know that, and so it's hidden in all sorts of trusts. But we would never knowingly approve any sort of non-recourse financing.
And I thought that was probably the case. So is anybody else – is there anything else that you feel you should respond to? Or
there was a lot, and we don't want to say
Well, yeah, it's about 16 minutes to.
I think in our mind – we really want to make sure it's very clear that the focus here is on the people doing the STOLE policies, not the consumer. The consumer wouldn't be guilty under any provision in the bill. The provisions dealing with insurance fraud require intent by their very nature. Insurance fraud requires that the person perpetrating the fraud intend to know that they are deceiving or committing the fraud. So there is no circumstance that we can think of where the insured would innocently be caught up in any of this. And that is something we have tried very, very hard to make sure that we were doing in both bills. And had a lot of help from Representative Knuth, Senator Scheid, Senator Moon, and everyone else who helped us put these two bills together.
Did you wish to say something, Mr. Riddell?
Madam Chair, I know the hour is late, so I'll be very brief. I just want to respond.
You need to identify yourself here for the.
Sorry. Yes. My name is Dwayne Riddell, and I'm General Counsel at Securing Financial Group. I know there's been a lot of talk by the other side about how the rebuttable presumption is unique. No other state has it. Well, what we have today is that every state that has passed the anti-COVID bill has a unique law. There is no uniformity whatsoever. And I would point out that Stephen Lineberg, who has been, I think, recognized by everyone here as an expert in this area and has even written a book about Scully, has described our bill as the most modern and well-considered of any he has seen. And he says that because it reflects a lot of effort to try to strike the right balance between trying to prohibit something that we all think needs to stop while protecting the legitimate rights of insureds who bought a policy for a legitimate reason and then want to sell it. In the case of Mr. Wolf, if he bought that policy, and I think he said he did, to protect his family because of this business, then he is, by definition, that is not a stolen policy because he bought it for legitimate reasons. It's only when a policy is initiated for the benefit of a third-party investor, and that's what this is all about. Provide brokers, agents that are working with seniors, and we will contrive a way to generate a policy for an investor, not a small policy, $5 million, $10 million, $15 million, who have turned this into a very lucrative business. Now, trying to stop this is all done in the virtual world of financial services, where smoke and mirrors are something to admire. So if you're going to stop it, you really have to have a bill that deals with belts and suspenders. And so you have a strong definition. You have a rebuttable presumption. You have a private cause of action. None of these are going to apply to innocent consumers, but hopefully they will be a very strong deterrent to stop what we all want to stop. So thank you for the time.
Mr. Riddell, thank you. Ms. Rowan, thank you. Members, Representative Knuth, did you want to say something? I think the people at the table concur with Senator Moore's statement in the beginning that you'd like to see something kind of based on the conversation we've had, and does anybody have anything else you'd like to see addressed or feel fine? And we are looking at, I'll let you
okay.
Say, is that possible? We're thinking about tomorrow.
We'd originally set it for tomorrow, but it sounded like several senators had some conflicts, so we're suggesting changing that to 6.
I think even Representative Hillstrom has a conflict at 4.
I'm sure other conference committees may pop up here and there.
And you do too.
Conference starts at 7.
Okay.
Okay.
The tax conference tomorrow. So
are you saying you'd both be done by 4:30?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So we can maybe do this at 4:30? Or 5? Because that would help. Well, that would jive better
thanks.
With this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then I think we'll send out an official notice changing it to 5, but we'll change it to 5 tomorrow afternoon in 500 North of the State Office Building.
And just if I could ask your guess then of how long it would go, what would be your backstop? I think people have other conflicts.
I think we would.
We would stop before 7
before
so
7.
That people could center rest.
I'm also on state government.
Right. I think it's meeting tomorrow at 3. So. I think.
Yes.
I think that's right.
Manager, it might or might not have been set. They tentatively reserved that. It was tentatively reserved that block of time, but I didn't know if Senator Bennett had confirmed for sure. I don't understand.
Okay.
It might have been.
Okay. So. With that, then, we will plan to meet tomorrow afternoon. And I want to thank everybody for being helpful and for participating so much. And thank the people who testified. The